Okay, this is sound roll number 42 for Fight in the Fields, a Paradigm production. We have a minus 8 dB reference tone to hollow on the modulometer, which equals 0 VU. Here comes Tom. Okay, we're now going to be interviewing Fred Ross Jr. We're in San Francisco at Delancey Street. We are running at 7.5 inches per second, and we're starting with take number one. And I think that's it. Here we go.
Well, that's what that cutter was for.
You might have to be facing more distance.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 87. We'll be starting with fresh roll camera roll number 88.
Speed. Rolling.
This is take one. Fred Ross, marker, junior.
Fred, we're going to talk a little bit about your dad and early recollections. Kind of thing, but several times Caesar said that your father was the best teacher that he ever had, the best organizer that he'd ever seen. What was so special about your father?
I think one of the qualities he had was that he had a drive that wouldn't quit. He had a burning passion inside of him to fight for justice, wherever that would take him. Someone once said that an organizer is part missionary, part educator, and part agitator. And my dad had all three of those qualities to the nth degree. And he could inspire people, and he could win their trust. And one of the reasons that he could win people's trust is that he really listened to people. When he went into a community, he didn't go in with the answers because he knew he didn't have them. And he also knew that in the Mexican-American community in the late 1940s and the 1950s, that he had one strike against him because he was white. And there was some built-in mistrust of white people. So he had to prove by his actions, by the way he related to people, and by the track record that the community service organization began to build. He wasn't afraid of controversy. Actually, he relished controversy. He loved nothing better than a good fight and to go after the meanest, biggest, baddest bully on the block and help people strategize and plan and go out and have fun doing it. So people loved to work with him.
What were your earliest recollections of this, of a good fight?
I'd say the DiGiorgio fight. I was a teenager, just finishing my first year of college. And I came back to the summer to the San Joaquin Valley and went down into Delano and Arvin Lamont, where my older brother Rob had been born in 1940 in the Sunset Labor Camp that Steinbeck wrote about, because my dad was working there in the 1940s. And DiGiorgio was the biggest corporate grower in California, and had just invited the Teamsters in and signed a sweetheart deal with the Teamsters, and had been forced because of political pressure to agree to an election. And in addition to DiGiorgio, the other big bully there was a guy named Jesse Marcus, who was the big mayordomo, the big foreman, who intimidated the hell out of people because he'd fire them, he'd threaten physical violence, and they also had a company store. And one of the things that my dad did was to use humor and ridicule to bring this big bully down to size. It was his idea to start publishing a daily mosquito zumbador, which I guess in Spanish means like the zooming, zinging, stinging mosquito. And that would publish the daily chisme, or funny story, that would come from the workers. And then they began to poke fun at Marcus. And that's when he began to lose his power, when people could laugh at him. He didn't know what to do with that. And in the end, against all the odds and all the big national, remember CBS commentator Terry Drinkwater was predicting that the powerful Teamsters were going to win this election and the farm workers didn't have a chance. Well, he didn't know what he was up against. He was up against my dad, he was up against Chavez, and a lot of farm workers whose loyalties were deep and strong and would come out on election day.
Now, you said that a good organizer can inspire, can bring out that passion. When you...
And a public health nurse told him about Caesar and Helen Chavez. So this was going to be one more couple that he'd go talk to. And somehow Caesar heard he was coming and thought it was going to be another, you know, anthropologist from Stanford or San Jose State coming down to ask Mexicans why they had so many babies and ate tortillas and beans. And he wanted to have nothing to do with another study. So he told Helen to tell this guy, Ross, that he wasn't home. And he waited across the street, I believe, at Richard's house, his brother. My dad came a second night, and again Helen lied for Caesar. And as my dad left, he said, well, I'll come back tomorrow night. So Helen sensed something real about my dad. So let's say, Caesar, I'm not going to lie for you one more time. If you don't want to talk to him, you tell him. So Caesar finally agreed to talk to him, but even then he didn't trust him. And my dad began to talk to him and ask him if he'd invite some people over to have a house meeting, which was the technique that my dad really began to use many years before, to bring people together in the privacy of their own home with their friends, where they have more confidence, they wouldn't be afraid of employers or other people intimidating them for getting organized. So Caesar had a plan, and the plan was he was a smoker at the time, he was gonna take a cigarette from his left hand to his right, and at that signal, one of the guys, and he ran with a tough crowd, guys who'd been in San Quentin and, you know, Pachucos, and one of these guys was gonna basically tell my dad to get lost and get the hell out of there. My dad had no idea that Caesar had this plan. So he comes in, and my dad began to tell the story of the Bloody Christmas case. This was a case in East LA, Boyle Heights, on a Christmas Eve when a couple of young Mexican-American veterans of World War II were taken out of a bar by the cops one night. Actually, they were standing in front of a bar. Cops pick them up for no reason, take them in and beat them bloody all night long. And the community service organization, which my dad was the organizer for, took that fight on. And for the first time in LA history, this is like in 1949, a police brutality case was not only prosecuted, but won, and those cops were sent to prison. And that story had spread like wildfire through every colonia in California. So when my dad began to paint the picture of how you build power, Caesar told me and many others later that a light went off in his mind. Wow, it's so simple. You could really bring about significant change by organizing. So Caesar forgot all about, he got all caught up in this story and forgot about the signal. Well, the guy was a little bit drunk too. And the guy began to get restless, so Caesar had to change the plan and walk him outside and then get back to the story. And my dad had another meeting that night, and Caesar went with him that night and every night for the next 3 weeks. And at the time, Caesar didn't write well enough to be a registrar of voters. So he did something even better, and that was to become the whip of the other registrars. And he made sure that they went out every night and registered people to vote.
Now, in those early years, I believe it was around 1952, what was your recollection of your dad meeting Dolores?
Well, I heard stories later that Dolores was suspicious of my dad. You know, there was a lot of red baiting in this period. This is the middle of the McCarthy period, and my dad is out organizing all over California and helping people stir things up and take on the most controversial issues, whether it was discrimination in the schools or police brutality. So there were those who accused him of being a communist. So Dolores checked him out. She had somebody who had a contact in the FBI. And the answer came back, no, the guy's not a communist. So after she checked him out, she agreed to work with him. And again, she told me one time that she said that my dad was out helping people get registered, and she was single at the time. So anybody who wanted to date Dolores had to go with her to register voters. And so they worked together for many, many years. And in a book that he never completed, he wrote about her, the chapter on Dolores was entitled, stop for a second here. The chapter on Dolores Huerta was titled Woman in Motion, which captures Dolores. OK? because you're always looking for Dolores. She's in the next town or the next city, stirring it up and educating people and agitating and organizing. And she was the first woman hired to be an organizer in the Industrial Area Foundation history, and that was probably in the early 1950s. My dad hired her to, I think, to be the about a year after he hired Caesar.
Okay. Now, talk a little bit about house meetings already, but I wanted you to tell us, you know, in organizing communities and organizing farm workers, what was significant about and important about the house meeting?
Well, I think the one of the most important parts of it is that.
Could you include house meeting in there?
So we sure. Okay. Yeah. House meetings were especially important in the early organizing amongst farm workers because there was so much fear. Organizing in most farm workers' minds meant strikes. And the history of organizing and the history of strikes in California farmworker history had been a bloody and a brutal one, and they had never won. There had been a lot of strikes in the 30s and the 40s, but the farmworkers in the end lost. So even the idea, the word union was a word that Caesar didn't even use in the first couple of years.
We're going to have to stop.
Okay.
These are short rules compared to videotapes.
Okay, oh, okay, that's the end of camera roll 88.
We'll
going to camera roll 89, our next take will be take
fear.
Two.
Yeah.
It's very
important.
Yeah. Okay, this is take two. Fred Ross Jr., marker.
Now, Fred, you were talking about house meetings and the element of fear. Could you go on and explain what was important about having those house meetings for farm workers?
Because of the past history of strikes being broken, of farm workers losing their jobs or being blacklisted, which meant they couldn't get a job, farm workers, if you're going to talk to them, you need to do it in private. You didn't go out and have a mass rally and announce that you were going to begin an organizing drive, because if you did, everybody who showed up would be on a blacklist, and then no one else would want to talk to you. And Caesar understood this. So when he found a farm worker who was interested and open, he'd ask if they'd invite a few of their friends over from their work crew or from other farms to talk about what was going on in the fields. So you have several things happening in a house meeting. One, you've got a part-time organizer, the person who's agreed to call the meeting. You're trading on their credibility and the relationships that they have built up with their friends and coworkers. And it's small enough, because you only should have maybe 6 to 10 people at this meeting, because you're looking for leaders. And you're also looking for anger. You want to draw people out. You want to get them to tell their story. Find out what they're angry about, what they'd be willing to organize for, what their hopes and dreams are, what kind of changes they'd like to see, what do they want to make happen. And in a house meeting, you can get at people's passion if you do it right, if you really listen to their story.
Now, how does it that your father came to organize farm laborers, farm workers in California? I mean, he organized in urban areas, he organized in rural areas. What drove him to farm workers?
Well, in the Depression, he couldn't get a job as a teacher. And there was a job working with farm workers in the Roosevelt administration. And so he took it. But he also, one of the first things he did was go out and tie carrots, because he wanted to find out what farm workers' lives were like, the people he'd be working with. And at that time, a lot of the farm workers were Okies, coming in literally from Oklahoma. This was the Woody Guthrie days. My dad met and got to know Woody Guthrie and Eleanor Roosevelt, who came out being the eyes and ears of FDR, came out to the ranches in the San Joaquin Valley. My dad took her around to see how horrible the conditions were. So it was the experience of the Depression that made my dad decide he wanted to go work with poor people, and one of the groups that was worse off in our society at the time were farm workers.
Now, your dad also believed in organizing not only labor, but voter registration, citizenship campaigns. What was the philosophy behind all of this organizing? Like, what was he going for?
Power. My dad understood in a very fundamental way that poor people or farm workers were never going to be able to change anything in their lives unless and until they began to build more power. So he would paint a very simple picture. On the one hand, you got to organize money, and that's what the growers and wealthy people have, and that's how they get what they want from the system, from politicians and business leaders. Politicians need two things to win. They need money, and they need votes. And in almost every community he would first start organizing in, most poor people didn't have votes. We knew they didn't have any money. What they had access to was the vote if they became citizens and if they got registered to vote, and finally, if they turned out to vote in big numbers. And the other element was to learn to hold every politician, regardless of their political party or race, to hold them accountable and to make them, put them on the spot and have them make commitments. One of the first times I saw politicians put on the spot, I was 16 years old, this is summer 1964, I was spending the summer with my dad in Guadalupe, Arizona, a little town south of Phoenix of about 7,000 people, about half Yaqui Indian and half Mexican American. And there was a local Republican member of the Board of Supervisors who had never come out to Guadalupe, ever. He didn't give a damn about Guadalupe because they weren't registered to vote. Well, after a few months of a House meeting drive and a voter registration drive, they registered 900 new people to vote. That got his attention. He was curious. He wanted their votes. He met with them. And the night that I saw him, the sun was setting on this little desert town, and they were having the first town meeting ever for the GO organization, the Guadalupe organization. And men and women, for the first time in their lives, were standing up, and they were putting this politician on the spot because he'd made a number of promises to him. He'd promised 10 miles of paved streets and 30 new stop signs and hire somebody locally as the deputy sheriff and take the post office out of the liquor store. And this was report card time. And he had begun to deliver. So even though he is a Republican, the question was, are you delivering? And he'd begun to deliver. And people began to feel their power.
Now, do you have any recollections of this kind of an event happening early on with the farm workers?
In the farm workers union?
Yeah. I mean, do you see any parallels there? Similar turnarounds like that where they stood up and held a person in power accountable. Do you recall any instances?
Well, the foreman I was talking about earlier, Jesse Marcus, went from absolute fear and terror of somebody who was in power to laughing at him and then having the guts to vote against the wishes of their employer, to Georgia, who was openly in bed with the Teamsters. And essentially what the organizing meant was that farm workers for the first time would be electing their own stewards, developing their own contract demands, and holding their employer accountable, because it was about bringing democracy and economic justice into the fields.
Now,
and a lot of politicians ended up feeling the sting of farm workers organizing, and not just in rural areas.
Okay.
I mean, the first time I remember going out, it was 1968, just after Caesar's Fast, I went down to meet my dad. And Caesar asked my dad to lead a registration drive in East L.A. because Bobby Kennedy had just announced as his candidacy for President of the United States. And this was the first of what would be many, many campaigns that farm workers would help wage in the cities of California, because there was a much bigger Latino vote potential in the urban areas than there was in the valleys. So hundreds and hundreds of farm workers would stream into East L.A. and San Jose and around and San Diego to help register and turn people out to vote, and to hold politicians accountable.
based on your recollections, how well did Caesar understand power? I mean, your dad understood power very clearly. What about Caesar?
Well, like I said, what he said, what Caesar told me was that when he first heard my dad tell that story of Bloody Christmas, and that the reason that they won that battle with the LA cops and they made history was that they had built up enough political power to make it happen. And that's what, that picture of power is what Caesar got immediately. And when Caesar made history in this country by being the first to successfully organize farm workers, he did it because he had a very keen sense of power. He understood that if he solely relied on a strike strategy, he'd never win. He went up against all the conventional wisdom by developing the boycott strategy. And that was building a whole different kind of power, crossing racial lines and economic lines and relying on middle-class Anglo consumers across the country and church people and students, the idealists on the campuses across the country, so that something like 17 or 18 million Americans or more boycotted grapes.
Now, talk about the boycott. I mean, there have been criticism about Caesar and the boycott, and basically criticism said, first time out, the boycott works, but if you rely solely on the boycott and you forget organizing, things fall apart. What's your take on that?
You've got to have both. And the reason that the grape boycott and the lettuce boycott and the Gallo boycotts were successful was that farm workers, thousands of farm workers, had gone out on strike. And in the summer of 73, something like 3,500 were arrested. Two were killed that summer, and hundreds were beaten bloody by the cops and the Teamster goons. And those photos and the footage from those bloody strikes, we were able to take out into the cities across the country and into Canada and Europe. So when we said there was blood on those grapes, we meant it. So the boycott weapon is far more powerful when it's based on strikes and farm workers organizing.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 89 and the end of sound roll 42.
Okay, speed up, pal.
42. And that was take number two.
You changing two?
Yeah, I'm changing two. We're continuing, right?
Yeah.
And that's the end of the sound roll, too.